investor requirements on the ROPA. And we'll be talking about what very different models can be for.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me lecture. And I'll be basically talking about some work that I've been doing with David Bernstein, Diego Correa, and myself over the last 2 years. And it's this is some work that I've been doing in N equals 4 super Young Miller's theory, especially at the Poland border. The motivation for this work, of course, we all want some non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity. I think everyone in this institute, even from other approaches to quantum gravity, are wishing you could have something like this. And you know, string theory itself will be something emergent from this non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity. And we don't have the complete theory like this so far, and string theory has been giving us some clues about this. But one of the most important clues that we have so far is the what we call the ABS-CFT correspondence. And in this correspondence, as you already heard in some other lectures, there's some relation between some large N SUN gauge theories and some string theories and some asymptotically ABS background. So I think this is a great example where we have an opportunity to actually formulate a non-perturbative definition of what we mean by string theory or quantum gravity in certain backgrounds. In this talk, I will study a special case of this, which is maximally supersymmetric Young Miller's theory. And in particular, I'm going to study some reduced sectors of the theory. I'm going to study the SU2 sector of super Young Miller's theory, and I'll explain what I mean by that. And this sector is described by some matrix quantum mechanical model. And as we will see, this model basically gives you a toy model of a quantum gravity in 3+1 dimensions, because the dual strings basically see an effective 3+1 dimensional spacetime. And well, in this talk, I will study quite directly the emergence of closed strings from this model, deep rings, and open strings. And we're even going to study the back reaction on the spacetime, and we're going to see how to compute or how to derive the presence of closed strings on some non-trivial backgrounds. And this is all encoded in a very simple matrix model. Although the matrix model is just, as I will explain, just a one look at, it's a one part of a very complicated, infinite, the true Hamiltonian, the full Hamiltonian has infinite terms, but I just take the first part as I will explain. But that part of the Hamiltonian is really very, very interesting. It has a lot of geometry in it, and hopefully I can convince you that we have a toy model of a quantum theory of gravity here. Now, well, I'm not going to review the whole ABS-CFT business because you already know this. And so, but basically, we have that N equals 4 super Young Miller's theory compactified on arc of string and with gauge group SUN. Is dual to some type 2B string theory in asymptotically ADS 5 versus 5 with n units of 5 form flux. Usually people say that this is dual to ADS 5, string theory in ADS 5 plus 5. This is not really true. It's just ADS 5 plus 5 is a special state, it's the ground state of the system. But in general, you can have other geometries here that are also asymptotically ADS 5 versus 5. Now, this duality is very peculiar. As you know, we need to take special limits because this theory looks so different from this. So the first thing we want to do is how do we uncover classical gravity? So we need to take the large N limit of the gauge theory because this is related to the 10-dimensional Planck length. So and here R is the radius of ADS 5 and S 5, which are the same. They have the same radius. So we need to take this radius way bigger than the Planck scale so we can have classical gravity. And this is what we call the large N limit in the gauge theory. Similarly, we want to suppress the string theory effects. So, and these are encoded in what we call the Dehuth coupling constant of the gauge theory, which we take to be fixed, but much larger than 1, or its inverse to be more less than 1, so we can have some control over a perturbative string theory. Now, in this correspondence, we have some isometries. There are some global symmetries of super Young Miller's theory, and these global symmetries are preserved at the quantum level. And these symmetries are dual to some isometries of the asymptotic ADS 5 versus 5. And in particular, in this talk, I will consider one of the subset of the symmetries, which is the what we call the R symmetry of the theory, and it's given by the group SL6, which is isomorphic to SC4, and this is dual to the isometries of the asymptotic S5. Now, I'm going to restrict myself even to a subsector of this, which is the SU2 subgroup of this. And remember, these are quantum symmetries, so all the states in this gauge theory will have some charge under this global symmetries. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss the SU2 scalar sector of Yang-Yun's theory. Remember, Yang-Yun's theory is super Yang-Yun's, so supersymmetric theory, so it has all the gluons and so and the gauge field. But here I'm only going to consider the scalar sector, and in the SU2 sector is composed of two scalar fields that in each one carries a unit of one U1 R sharp under this SU4, and the duality here is that these states are dual to string theory state or quantum gravity state that have two angular momenta on the asymptotic S5 on the boundary. Now, this model is really, the basis for this model is very simple. It's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators, one for each one of these scalar fields, and they obey the usual commutator rules. Now, the difference is that they have some indices because we're working in SUN or UN, depending on your taste. And so we have multiple traces of these oscillators. I put some letters Y and Z denoting the two different charges. And each one of these charges, again, is given by some angular momentum in two orthogonal planes in this S5. So this is the typical state, and this vacuum is the state annihilated by the annihilation operator of each one of them. So the usual vacuum that you're used to. And so in this sector, the particular sector, we'll see that the string sees a reduced 3+1 geometry. Here I wrote R cross S3. This is a special case. In general, it sees a more complicated geometry, but it is effectively a 3+1 dimensional geometry. In some sense, you can think of this string states or quantum gravity states to be like point-like in the ADS directions and in the other directions in the sphere, and only extending on a 3+1 dimensional space. Now, the Hamiltonian for the SU2 sector of Yang-Yun's theory has been studied a lot, and, well, as I said, it has infinite number of terms, that really complicated expression. We don't know the full form of this Hamiltonian. We know it up to like four loops, and if you want to go beyond that, you have to use techniques like Bethe ansatz, which I'm not going to discuss here. But in this case, I'm just going to truncate myself to just going to see this one loop version of the Hamiltonian here, lambda against the tooth coupling, and I introduced h bar, which is 1/n, just notational. So in this case, I have redefined my Hamiltonian by subtracting the two generators, the two angular momentum generators here, which are like usual ones, and they anyway say they commute with Hamiltonian, so I'm allowed to redefine my Hamiltonian this way. So I just want you to take a look at this. This is a very simple matrix model. This is like the simplest thing you can imagine with these two oscillators coupled together. And we can extract a lot of geometry just from this simple model. And of course, the dream then later on at the end, I will go back to try to see what, you know, speculate what could go on in the strong coupling. I just want to change notation a little bit. I'm going to introduce coherent states, because instead of using these operators and all the hats and all stuff, I just use coherent states easier for notation purposes, and it's easier to make particular calculation. So this is just the usual coherent state that you study in quantum mechanics, just with indices now. So the most general states in the system will be some wave function on this creation operators, and this will translate to a wave function of these two matrices. These, of course, have to be gauge invariant objects, so this is multiple traces of these things, and the same here. The Hamiltonian translates very simply. These are matrix derivatives. And this is the cool thing about this notation is that, you can compute inner products of states just using random matrix theory. And this is the SUN invariant measure on the space of matrices. And remember, these are complex matrices. These are not normal matrices nor Hermitian. These are complex matrices. So this is how we define the inner prime. All right, so I think we're ready to jump into seeing how do we see the closed strings arising from this model. The first guess is that single trace states are dual to single string states, and multiple traces are dual to multiple string states, and that's it's pretty much correct. I consider a single trace state, and of course we have to take the large and limit to do any of these computations. So in the large and limit, you can show that this Hamiltonian only can act on nearest neighbor sides. For instance, if I apply this derivative to this y here, this one has to go to this z here, not to the other sphere, because otherwise we generate non-planar interactions, which are suppressed in the large and limit. Now we want to find a nice way of writing this Hamiltonian, this action on the states. For that, I will introduce a new notation, which is very simple. I just labeled the most general, this is the most general SK2 single trace state. We can map that to what we call the bosonic lattice. So we just label the state by the number of C fields between each Y. So I have N1Z, N2Z, and then I can think of this as a state with N1 bosons on the first side, N2 bosons on the second side, and so on. And this state is, of course, periodic because of the cyclicity of the trace. So this is my basis now, and I want to know what is the action of the Hamiltonian on this basis in the large and limit. So if you do your computations right, and you find that this Hamiltonian is very simple, it can be given by this simple lattice system. And here A and A dagger are just the shift operators. This one increases the number of bosons by one, and A dagger is the inverse, decreases the number of bosons by one. And in this Hamiltonian, you can see there are terms that preserve the number of bosons in each side, and then there are terms that have hopping between the two sides. And I just want to mention, I'm not going to go into these details here, but this is just the usual Heisenberg ferromagnet disguised in a different notation. So, but I'm not going to go into these details here. I'll use this notation because it's more useful for what I'm going to do later on. Right. So once you have this Hamiltonian, you want to try to study what is the if there's any useful classical limit of this Hamiltonian, and what is the string theory description of this. So the first thing you do is try to build coherent states. That's what you do in quantum mechanics. So you do it here, you build coherent states of this A operator, and they have this simple form. And then once you have coherent state, there's a very general prescription to compute the action on coherent states. And this is what we do. This first line here is very general. Once you have a set of other complete coherent states, you can do this and construct the action for them. And this is well known in condensed matter and other fields too. So this is very general for any coherent states. And in our particular case, this action takes this simple form. But now I want to take some sort of classical limit. So I need to put some big number here to act as like an inverse Planck length. So what I do is I take L. Remember, L is the length of the lattice, which is the number of Y fields in my single trace operator. So if I take L to be very large, then this action here becomes this reduced sigma model, where V is defined here. And z only takes values inside the unit this. So you see that in the large L limit, this thing becomes really classical because this number becomes very big. So here, you know, we need to take lambda also to be big, the same order of L squared. So this term doesn't vanish with comparison with this term. Right? So when you have coherent states, you just compute the propagator between coherent states, and you slice it in pieces like you do in usual quantum mechanics, divide it in time slices, very small, and then insert the over complete set of coherent states in each side. And when you take the limit of infinite size, you get an effective action for coherent states. This is very general for any quantum system with some Hamiltonian and some coherent states. So people use this in spin chains and another system. So this line here is very general, and this is my special case. So there's an underlying assumption that these coherent states are already complete. You can show that in this case, but it's more complicated for others. I'm not going to go.
So I thought that before you did a truncation in one loop, then when the condition for the truncation was that lambda is small, and now you're taking an inconsistent limit,
Okay, that's a good point. All right. So yeah, it seems that I want to take lambda large here. All right. So at this point, I could just say, okay, I'm looking at this system. I don't care where it is. I just have some quantum mechanical system. I just want to look at it and see what I get. From the string theory point of view, we'll see that what is going on is that when you take this L to be large, and especially, I'll say this later, but this ratio here, you want to take this ratio to be less than 1 or much less than 1, but fixed in this limit. In that limit, you find that the bosonic action has a very nice expansion in this parameter. So it turns out that this taking the limit of large angular momenta suppresses the quantum effects of lambda. And that's why we can do the comparison with the string theory. But it's not obvious at first. It seems like an inconsistency. But you know, of course, there's an order of limit thing here, but I'm not going to go into that. But it is. I'll show how you derive this action from the string theory. And then you can see that it is consistent to take first L big and then lambda big. I think the deeper explanation is because there's some sort of supersymmetry in this system. The systems they're not supersymmetric. The states are not supersymmetric, but the SC2 sector has some pretty nice properties. It's a closed sector and all that. So, but just the way the sigma model behaves, it admits this kind of comparison. So the claim here, I don't want to make a huge deal about this, but I think the main point that you'll see in this talk is whenever you can take a classical limit on this reduced quantum mechanical model, it agrees with the string theory. I don't have a formal proof that that's true for every single state you can imagine, but it seems that that is the case. And the other thing is that I'm taking lambda large, but I remember the lambda is actually fixed, so you can imagine doing perturbation theory order by order of lambda. So you can actually compute other terms if you take the other corrections. So, all right, I'll just say that already, that large angular momentum is a classical limit here. Now, let's try to see what is the string theory interpretation of this. For that, we consider a string moving an arc as a string. And I'm going to use this coordinate. These are coordinates of the S5, so I put the string at x equals it. These are complex coordinates. This is S5, so I put the string is not like point in this plane. And I use this parameterization for the trajectory of the string in the other directions. And it's the time component, and r is here. Now I give a picture of this, and in this coordinates, apart from this choice of sign here, like the upper hemisphere of the S2 is mapped to this disk, and R is the coordinate on this disk, and there's an S1 fiber, which is this one here, over this disk, which lives in a sort of flat complex plane. And this parameterization of the S2 will be very important later on when we consider other space times, like this happy BF geometry. So once you do that, right, I'm not going to go into all the details, but the trick is that you go to the polar convection, and you don't pick the usual conformal gauge. You pick a gauge that is more natural from the point of view of the gauge theory. So there's a gauge where you distribute the angular momentum in this S1 uniformly along the string. So this is the angular momentum density in this direction, and you pick this to be a constant, and you pick this time slicing. So L here is the angular momentum. I used the same letter as ADHD because actually they turn out to be the same thing, just given by this expression. So once you do that, then there's kind of a long process of implementing the Virasoro constraints and all that. But you can show that in the limit where L is very big, with this ratio here fixed but less than 1, the polyhedral of action reduces exactly to this form, which is exactly what I found using the matrix model. So, and then the other correction, you can show that there are powers of this coefficient here. So that's why we can do this comparison. Now, so I will show you that we can. So the upshot up so far is that the single trace states are dual to single strings, and they become classical, at least in this reduced matrix model. They are classical in the when you take large angular momentum along some S1 fiber. In that case, they behave exactly like you expect from a string theory.
Okay. Can you elaborate how you get this third order action from the
polyfill? All right, yeah. So, okay. So you write the action, first you write the action in momentum space. And so you have the Lagrangian, so the Lagrangian will be something like the momentum. And then you implement the Virasoro constraint directly here. So at the end of the day, you write the action, the Lagrangian, as a function of momentum, x dot, y. So there are two Virasoro constraints. One of them, you use one of the Virasoro constraints to eliminate this coordinate, the prime of this coordinate, the S1. The second one, you use it to solve for PT, which is dual to basically the Hamiltonian density. And you plug that back in, and then you get something like this. And this coordinate will be the other two coordinates, like this complex coordinates here. Will be like the two of so and then the momenta. So and then the momenta.
How can you have the Lagrangian depend both on x dot and p?
No. So okay. So when you write the Lagrangian, well, you have some. There's something like this, the full form. Something like this. You start with this and. So this is my initial Lagrangian. And you can show that this is exactly the same. If you solve for A and B, it's exactly the same as the usual polytrop function. So A and B serve as Lagrangian multipliers to implement the constraint. Let me just correct something. All right, so first you solve these constraints. So with this constraint, you solve for PT. For this constraint, you solve for phi prime. I'm sorry, that's why I made a mistake here. So at this point, you have something that depends on the primes only, right? And it's linear, of course. It depends on also in this. You have this term here, so it also depends on the dot, right? So what you do because of this term. So what you do is you solve for the momenta in terms of the time derivatives. Because the momenta, when you do this and put it back here, when you put PT back here, PT will depend on the other momenta. So at the end, the action will only depend on the momenta, the time, the spatial derivative, and the time derivative. So you solve for the momenta just algebraically. You put them back in the action. And then that's how you make the expansion. Then there's a procedure where you can actually find an effective action that is higher orders in the spatial derivative, but linear in the time derivative, and that's a complicated procedure. But there's a procedure for going. So I hope that.
Maybe we can expect it.
Yeah, it's kind of technical, so I didn't want to go into that. It's well known, like paper by Krasinski and other people do this. So I did invent this method. All right. So now we can ask, what happens when you have a heavy state like a D brain. So can we have such a state in the matrix model? So the claim is that this kind of anti-symmetric states is a D-brain. In the last talk, you heard something about states like this. So here, epsilon is just the anti-symmetric symbol. And p is less, but I would take p to be similar to n. So the claim is that a state like this, remember that a heavy state like this will be dual to a giant graviton in type 2B string theory. And there are different kinds of giant gravitons, but the ones that I'm going to discuss in this talk are the ones that live on the S5. So in this case, the giant graviton is a solution to the Bornfeld action, and it's a S3, it's a spherical giant graviton, a spherical D3 S3 brain that travels along, in this coordinates, traveling along a circle in this plane, and the radius of the circle is given in terms of the P, which is the angular momentum of the giant graviton, and this is a VPS object. So it's a point here. I'm drawing S3, but this S3 is really a fiber over this disk. So let's see how do we recover, how can we see that this is really the correct operator for this? So the approach is to probe it. Let's try to put an open string on this operator and see if we can get the right action and the right boundary conditions.
So, yeah. What was Z in the geometry? Is Z plane of the Monty as a Monty or something?
In that letter or in the geometry?
No, in the small z, like for which you have the action. Is that a particular
point? Oh, yeah, no, yeah. That is just inside of this, I'm sorry. Small z here, it's a coordinate inside the disk. So I call it C plane, but it's really defined inside the disk. So z is r e to the I phi, and just the coordinate inside the disk. So it's just the parameterization of the disk of the well it, of the S3 in terms of a disk and some S1 fibers. Okay. So the C here is they're sort of related, you know, because they're basically related, but this is the one from the HQ. So if you put a probe string on this, this is the way you do it. You attach a word like this, a lattice, pretty much like the one that I studied before for the closed string, but now it has some sort of Champaton factors, which are the gauge indices that are sort of attached to this D-brain system. So, and we label this as a bosonic lattice. And once you do that, if you do your counts correctly and you apply the Hamiltonian to this system in the larger limit, you find that the Hamiltonian has a very nice form. The first three terms are very similar to the Hamiltonian that we had before. These are those shift operators. And remember that I'm acting on this basis. But now this is not periodic anymore. We don't have the cyclicity of the trace here in this work. So there are two interesting terms here. The last two terms that do not concern the number of bosons. So in this case, you can see that you can have a bosons leaving the first side or entering the first side on the or the last side and leaving or entering the last side. And in what is happening at, in the operator level is that you can exchange a Z field between this D brain and the open string. And physically, what this means is this means that the D brain is basically dragging this open string. Remember that these D brains are actually rotating. So this is the angular momentum exchange between the D brain and the string mapped to this matrix model.
Sorry, in the 66, the spin chain language, part of the boundary
theories? Oh, for the spin chain, okay, see, if you want to discuss this in a spin chain language, this is very weird because it's a spin chain that doesn't have a fixed number of sides. So if you have, like, at the end, what you have is something like this, up, down, down, and then somehow, here you can lose a downspin, for instance. Right? So the way we parameterize that this in a spin chain language is like if you have n1, n2, this is equal to a spin up and they say n1 spin down and so on and so forth. So you see that this boson sinks and sources corresponds to spin chains that don't have a fixed number of sides. But this is not even like studied in condensmer or anything because it's very weird. I think the most natural language is in language of a bosonic lattice. And there's no, I don't know even how to define an S matrix or like a, you know, usually you have some reflection matrix. You can define a Bethe answer with a reflection matrix. I don't even know what that means in this language. So, but we can say a lot of things about this. You know, once we have this Hamiltonian, we can do the same trick of trying to get the classical limit. And doing the same thing with coherent states, we find the same, this is a Hamiltonian in coherent states, and you find the same Hamiltonian as before. I'm not going to show the full action, the rest of the action, the linear part in time is the same as before. But now the Hamiltonian has two pieces that come from the boundaries. Now, here we want to take a limit. Remember that L goes to infinity, but we want to also take lambda to be big, because otherwise in the action, the second term will be vanishingly small with respect to the time derivatives. So in that case, when lambda is big, these two terms will cost a lot of energy. So the lowest energy configuration will have to have this constraint set to zero. And if you set these guys to zero, the only way is to impose this boundary, Dirichlet boundary conditions on the ends of the string. And this is precisely the location of the giant graviton. So hopefully I'm convincing you that this bosonic lattice in the thermodynamic limit behaves as an open string on a D3 brain, spherical D3 brain. All right. So we've seen closed strings, we've seen open strings and D brains, and they all agree with the string theory in the classical limit where you have a large angular momentum. Now, there's something interesting because this Hamiltonian, as is written here, has a very degenerate ground state. And we were only considering a single trace or some other fluctuation around the usual ground state, which is annihilated by the annihilation operators. But you can consider any function of z in this coherent state language, and it's going to be annihilated by this because it doesn't have any y to operate. And moreover, some of these ground states will behave semi-classically in the Larsen limit. And as an example, I want to study this kind of ground states, this wave function, which are some exponential of some potential, holomorphic potential in Z. The intuitive thing is that this will give me some gravitational back reaction. So we're going to get some strings and some other complicated, probably complicated geometry. So let me explain how do you probe these such a heavy states. So first of all, these states can be mapped to some droplets, and I'll explain briefly how you do that. The first is that the normalization of such states in this coherent state language is given by this product of integrals over the eigenvalues of that matrix Z. And here W is this potential with this extra piece that comes from the state. This term here gives you the usual repulsion. So you recognize this is a classical problem in random matrix theory and the 2D Coulomb gas. So in this case, when we take large and limit, you replace the sums here by integrals over some density of eigenvalues, and this is very familiar. So you try to extremize this effective free energy for the system. This is the saddle point approximation in the exponential, but you have to impose the constraint that the number of eigenvalues is equal to n. Once you do that, without going too much details, and you already saw some of this in the previous talk, you get this landscape of constant density droplets in a complex plane. So depending on that potential omega that you give me, you can get some very interesting, very complicated shapes. Some of them will have non-trivial topology like this, or homotopy like this. So, and you can have multiple droplets like this, and it turns out that the density of eigenvalues is constant along any of these droplets in the complex. And let me, yeah.
Well, I have a question. The fact that you can make any omega function, any function of z, seems to depend on your choice of ordering on the Hamiltonian. So if you choose an ordering where the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, but if you really symmetrize and make it Hermitian, then you will have some cross term. And that.
Oh, okay.
So in that case,
yeah, all right.
You don't expect any function.
Well, my Hamiltonian came directly from a gauge theory calculation.
That should work with the Hermitian.
It's Hermitian. My Hamiltonian is Hermitian.
You know the derivatives on the right.
That's in coherent state, but in the usual operator language, it was something like this. So, I mean, if you take the Hermitian conjugate, it's other two Hermitian. So, well, it's normal order, but that comes naturally from the gauge theory. When you do the calculation, you derive this from the one loop dilatation operator, it comes out that way naturally. The thing that you might be also worried about is that I define h minus the angular momentum. So, if for h only, here, if I take this angular momentum to the other side, these are not eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So these are eigenstates of this shifted Hamiltonian. So there's a choice of time slice, and there are two possible observers. One of the observers is rotating with the system. There's some angular momentum, and the other observer is not rotating with the system. And so these states that I'm describing are only eigenstates, are ground states of this system that they combine.
Maybe my question is, normal ordering is okay when you're quadratic operators, you take the case particle derivative on that. The choice of order means that you drop some derivative terms. Right? So there's a choice of order in there for which you get this conclusion. There might be some other choice where you get more restriction on the.
All right. There's some, okay, suppose that I have some random, you're worried there's some bubble diagram that this will act on this, and so, right, so that happens in the gauge theory. When you calculate this thing in the gauge theory, it happens, but because you have supersymmetry, remember you have to sum over the fermion loops, and you have to sum over the gauge theory, the gauge field corrections to the propagator. So those things cancel this other bubble diagram that you're talking about. So this come out naturally from the gauge theory. It's in this paper by Beiser. It's just a one loop. But yeah, I know that you generally will expect some other ordering, but those other terms are canceled by fermion loops, basically. That's the short answer. You just have to do all the diagrams and sum them in, and they cancel out. And this is the only interaction that really matters at the end.
Can we say this is similar to, say, a lambda geometry?
Oh.
Once I have
adopted,
I can reconstruct
the 2-dimensional moment. I'll get back to this. These are the LM here. I haven't mentioned that, but that's my goal. This is the LM. So I'm going to show you how I recover even the metric inside this droplet by the matrix model calculation, the full metric inside of this. So let me give you just a couple of examples. For no potential, we were studying the unit disk. I remember that unit disk arises naturally in the use of coherent states, but now we see that there's a connection here with the random matrix model. This is the usual ground state. The distribution of eigenvalues also take value in this unit disk, so there was no coincidence that we were seeing this parameterization of the S3. So it's just a consequence of this random matrix model. But we can take all the droplets, like if you, for instance, consider a quadratic potential like this, you get an elliptical droplet. A cubic potential, you get a droplet like this. And these droplets have been studied in the random matrix theory literature. And in the other lecture, you saw something similar, I think, to this, well, with a arbitrary coefficient. And all this can be, this shape can be calculated exactly in this coefficient. All right. Now, let's go back to that LM thing. All right. So I want to know what the state looks like from the point of view of gravity. And when I have a quantum theory like this, it's supposedly quantum theory of gravity, I need to probe this state with some matter to see how the sigma model looks like and if I can read off the metric. So to do that, let's try this, just what we did before, a single trace state. But now we include the presence of this heavy ground state here. So this is an approximate notion of an Albert product here, but this is just it's nothing deep really. And we can map this to some lattice. I put some numbers here. I'm not assuming that they're integers or anything. It should be some wave functions that I have to determine on Z. They can be very complicated in general. And when I take Larson limit, the normalization of this state factorizes in this form once you integrate out the white field. And here, the expectation value means, sorry, this is too small here, but it's just the usual expectation value of the other matrix model, and now including the full potential. So this W here is the W that you saw before, this W here. So this is a complicated problem. Calculating this thing here, this is a complex matrix model. This is not a normal matrix model. So in general, these correlation functions are not known how to, there's no literature how to do this in general for complex matrix model. So I will develop some techniques for that. So what we want is some set of wave functions that are orthonormal under this integration. Right. So let's first assume that you have this. Assume that such wave functions exist.
Can you rephrase this in the language of the operator language? It's in AJCFT. What does this all mean?
It's this just.
So this is in your matrix.
In the matrix model, yeah.
But in the gauge theory.
Okay.
A simple picture.
Oh, sure. This is just a correlator that you use all the time.
But that cannot be a BPS operator, right?
No, this is not a BPS, no.
So but I thought that you truncated your discussion to a BDSM set.
No, no. All right, so, okay, let me clarify some things. In the gauge theory, you define your basis as weak coupling, as zero coupling. That's how you define your basis of states. And then you turn on the coupling and you see how that basis mixes. And then finite coupling, you have some Hamiltonian. The thing is that at zero coupling, you only have Gaussian integrations, right? So you have two operators and two gauge invariant operators, and then you're going to have some combinatorics, and we'll give you something like the x2. This is the dimension of the operator, some number here. But the combinatorics involved in computing these correlation functions are just that you do them with the usual, with this usual propagator. But now this propagator will have, I don't have a phrase yet. I think it's applied.
Square.
All right. So you have, this is the usual propagator, free field theory propagator for this theory. And the thing is that you can sort of renormalize this mode so you can absorb this in your definition of the operator. And at the end, you can encode everything in this combinatorics factors. And these are the same combinatorics factor that comes from a matrix model. So that's why we can translate the problem of computing correlation functions correlation function of local pair operators in terms of a matrix model. That's just the trick to encode this this behavior. And because they all have this same kind of spatial dependence, then you can sort of strip off this and just look at the combinatorial factors. So it's all combinatorics, you know. So once you assume that this wave function exists, then you can prove the following. You can prove that the Hamiltonian acting on that basis that I just showed you before is given by this lattice system. And here the identification is this: each one of these n's is dual to one of this wave function. I define the zero wave function, some reference wave function, to be just the identity matrix. But more interestingly, this looks pretty much like the Hamiltonian that I had at the beginning of this bosonic lattice. But here we have something very interesting. There's some beautiful algebraic structure underlying this operators. You can prove this algebraic structure for any reasonably well-behaved omega that have been some power law expansion. And here, L dagger inverse is defined by the left multiplication. And these coefficients can be explicitly calculated in terms of the density of eigenvalues of the matrix model, of the holomorphic matrix model. The zero is a projection to this reference state. So you see that, you know, you can define the whole thing in terms of this algebra for general omega. So now we need to find out examples of how to find an explicit representation of this algebra so we can explicitly construct this wave function.
Any questions?
So I skipped a lot of stuff here, and this, just to show this is a whole paper, you know, so this is the end result. Now, how do we find a representation to that algebra? We just assume, as usual in matrix models, and well, not in matrix models, in orthogonal polynomials, you assume that these wave functions are polynomials of degree n, and they will obey some recursion relation with some unknown coefficients that depend only on the number here or the degree of the polynomials. So once you assume this, you can show that the operator L dagger and L has an expansion just like this in terms of this, again, shift operator. And the beautiful thing is that this unknown coefficient, these unknown functions, are completely determined by the algebra that you just saw before. And this algebra completely determines these coefficients for any potential. So I think, so now we're ready to go and calculate some of these things and see what we get. Again, we want to calculate coherent states to get a sigma model from this Hamiltonian. So in this case, I define the coherent states to be the eigenstates of this L operator. And you can show that they have this form where phi is, again, the same wave function. So this wave function that I introduced in the beginning can be constructed explicitly using this recursion relation once you know the coefficients. So you take the algebra, solve for the coefficients, and then solve for the wave function. And that also allows you to build the coherent states. So once you have the coherent states, the range of this coordinate z will be given by the normalization condition. We want this to be normalizable. So once you do that, you follow the same procedure of calculating the action on coherent states, and you find the following thing. You find an action that is pretty much the same, the thing that I had before, very universal. But now this v one form is actually given by this derivative of this logarithmic log of this sum over this polynomials. Right, so now we want to try to see what is the interpretation of this from the string theory point of view. So we have to look at this LLM geometries. But before that, let me just give you some examples. For the circular droplet, we have no potential. We get the simple algebra of the shift operators. The wave functions are simply z to the n. Normalization tells you that the state has to be, it's only normalized inside the unit disk. So that's how you recover from this wave function. You recover the shape of the droplet just by the normalization condition. And the V1 form takes the value that we saw before. You can consider other droplets, for instance, the elliptical droplet. You put this quadratic potential, epsilon is, you can take epsilon to be real without loss of generality. And you can show that L dagger takes this form, and the phis are the Chebyshev polynomials of the second kind. You can compute explicitly the sum over these polynomials, and you see that the coherent states are only normalizable inside an ellipse. This equation, when you set the denominator to zero, is the boundary of an ellipse of eccentricity epsilon in complex coordinates. So you see again the shape of the distribution of eigenvalues is reflected in the normalization of this coherent states. It is exactly the same equation that you get from the usual matrix model techniques for a holomorphic matrix model, where you can actually integrate out the orthogonal models. All right, so let's go to the gravity picture. We saw that the classical ground state that you saw are dual to this so-called LLM geometries or half BPS geometries. These are complicated 10-dimensional space-time of type 2B supergravity. But and these geometries were found by Maldacena, Lund, and Linen, and they found something very interesting is that the whole geometry is determined by a single function that takes two discrete values and some two-dimensional hypersurface, so say minus 1 half plus 1 half. And that requirement comes from the requirement of having a singularity-free geometry, regular geometry. So in these geometries, you can visualize this patches of this function where it takes two values like droplets on a complex plane. And the full geometry is built from that in the following way. We have this extra spatial dimension, and we have two S3s that are fiber over the whole space. And of course, we have the time direction. So in total, we have the 10-dimensional space-time. And these space-time are very complicated. They have complicated topologies. If you have two separate droplets like this, you will get like an S5 here and another S5 here. So they're very complicated. But now, I'm looking at the SU2 sector of the gauge theory. And this SU2 sector corresponds to strings that only live inside the droplets. So in this reduced sector, the string lives here and rotates or also has angular momentum along a S1 fiber. So you see that this is the natural generalization of that picture that I showed you at the beginning of that circular droplet, but now we have more complicated droplets. And again, the dictionary is that the number of white fields in the operator or in the lattice is dual to the angular momentum, the units of angular momentum on this S1. So now I want to ask what is the effective sigma model of a string in such a complicated background, and if I can compare that to the matrix model calculation.
I don't understand the background here. In this case, unlike, again, coming back to my question, in the LLM case, I can reconstruct the full 10-dimensional supergravity, and I can actually cancel that source. That would be my question of motion. In this case, do we have
this is a subspace of that geometry.
We have a string.
they only see the piece of the geometry.
Right. So this is a subspace of that, but this, the full geometry is there, it's just the string is restricted. It's like when you take this SE2 sectoring in ADS 5 cross 5, the string is effectively living in R cross string.
Right.
So in this case, it's effectively living in this drawer.
So I see. So what you mean by imagine emergent geometry, it's the emergent geometry as seen by the string.
By the string.
You're not moving in. Okay, so I just thought.
We'll discuss all that at the end. But yeah, the problem is that you can so there are some state, some heavy state. You can think of it as dual to some background, but you don't really know that until you probe it. So you need some probe to measure the metric and see how particles behave, and that's how you actually measure. So it's kind of different from other approaches to quantum gravity, where if you have only metric here, of course, string theory you have matter, so that allows you to. And the matter and the geometry is made of the same stuff. So that this two matrix model makes everything in the space time and the string itself is made of the same kind of matrices. So that's something very interesting. I think it's less for quantum gravity. Now, this is the metric inside the droplet. Again, the metric is more complicated outside of the droplet. There are also the other factors with the other S3s, but I'm not gonna use them in this doc. So this is the metric inside that droplet, and with that S1 fiber that I just talked to you about, the z-bar coordinates are complex coordinates and are restricted only to this droplet. And remember that you can have disconnected droplets too. So you can have disconnected space-times, space-like separated space-time. This V is a one form that is built out of this sort of Taylor potential in quotes because there's some square root factors, but. But and this function H can be also built out of the same potential. And the gauge theory, the string theory here, the gravity picture, this potential is totally determined by the boundaries of this droplet. So you have a sum over integration, contour integration over the different boundaries. So if you have two different droplets, you go over two boundaries. Or if you have the droplet with a hole, you have to take an integration over the exterior boundary, then over the interior boundary with appropriate orientation. So you can calculate all this thing quite explicitly, but in general, this is a very complicated function. So you get a very complicated V and a very complicated H here. However, if you take a sigma model on this reduced geometry and take the fast spin limit along this S1 fiber, you can show that the effective sigma model becomes this very nice action, which is exactly what we found before, said that now, well, these coefficients are given by this derivative of this Taylor potential that is determined by this integral. So what so the form matches the matrix model calculation. What we need to check is that this coefficient here is the same. And once you calculate this coefficient, you can calculate the other because it's just the derivative of this. So the full metric inside of this droplet is reconstructed with the knowledge of this one form, if we can know this one form from the gauge theory point of view.
So, Sasha, you've checked if you put a string, you made some answers for the string that's going to only be moving in some plane, and it's sitting at the point everywhere else. So
yeah.
Have you checked that that's the solution of the full water equation or not?
The polygraph.
This is similar to what Martin.
Yeah, it's just exactly the same technique using different different coordinates. Yeah, they're the same techniques. Exactly, and so you can define this systematically and calculate all the other expansion, all the other coefficients in the expansion, and you can actually later, if you go to higher loops in the gauge theory, you can match coefficient by coefficient. I haven't shown that because it's kind of complicated, and really I didn't want to go into those details, but. But it's possible, and it's quite straightforward to do it. Just a bit tedious. Now, once you have that, and taking into account this relation, if you remember from the matrix model point of view, we have that V was some also some derivative of some logarithm of some sum over polynomials. So using this, you can see that this sum over polynomials can be directly mapped to this potential here. So we can reconstruct the full metric using from the matrix model point of view if we just calculate this wave functions. So that's what I did in the last paper that came out, I think, yesterday. I calculated some examples, and you can check for all the examples that I wrote down, like the elliptical droplet and this very complicated droplet shape here with a cubic polynomial. You can make an expansion A and match all these terms. You calculate this B from the gauge theory. You also calculate from string theory. They totally match. So you see how you can recover the full metric with the matrix model. And there's some very interesting relation between the metric and this wave function, and this wave function obeys some algebraic structure. So there's some things there that I don't fully understand, but something interesting is going on here. Right. So I think the upshot of this, I'm just going to conclude here. Just want to say that this model is basically, you saw it's a toy model for quantum theory of gravity in 3 plus 1. And then 3 plus 1 reduced space-time. You saw that we have what we call heavy states that behave like space-time itself, like some other geometry, like back-reactor geometry. We can put probes on them and actually try to measure part of that geometry looking at the sigma model. We can even have deep brains and open strings on them. So, you know, there's a lot of physics of ADS-CFT that's really captured by this model, and each time you take classical limit of this model, it seems to agree with the string theory. Now, I think the larger picture here is that we have some very interesting dualities between seemingly very different systems, and I think this is like in the long run what we really want to explore here. So at the quantum level, you have this matrix model. And remember, this matrix model is like something over all geometries, right? Because geometries are special states, right? So you have a lot of states here, and if you compute like the path integral of this matrix model, it will sum over all possible geometries and all possible string configurations. So this is really like quantum version, quantum gravity in a sense. And only in the larger limit, you have classical gravity. So the N provides a natural cutoff. And it is a pretty solvable model. You know, you can do a lot of computations. But the interesting thing is that you can go from this matrix model to a discrete lattice systems. And you saw this bosonic lattice, three of them, this lattices. And then you can go from here to the sigma model by taking some large angular momentum limit. But if you start at strong coupling from the sigma model of string theory, and I'm talking here, it's all bosonic string. You see that enlarged L limit also reduces to this sigma model. So now there's a natural question, of course. We would like to understand this matrix model at large lambda. This is the goal. And we understand some of the perturbative terms here, but they get more and more and more complicated. So it's really hard to write down a Hamiltonian for this system at large n. We don't know what the Hamiltonian is. We have some clues about that integrability has given us. For instance, we can go from the sigma model to some lattice system, but we don't know the Hamiltonian for this system. We only know the what's called the Bethe ansatz. So you can visualize this system as some integral system, spin chain, long range spin chain, and you just only define the S matrix of the system. So we don't know the Hamiltonian of the system. But it will be very interesting to go from here to understand how can you write down the Hamiltonian of the matrix model at large lambda. Maybe there's some simplifications. And some partial results have been produced in these papers, arguing that there's some matrix model, simple matrix model that describes this limit here. But you know, this direction here that I show you, I think it's a very interesting area to pursue. These three objects that seem to be very unrelated, they do have very interesting relationships. And if you had a matrix model of large lambda, if you had the full matrix model only in the SU2 sector, I'm even just concentrating myself in the SU2 sector, scalar sector, this will give you a very complete, pretty complete model of a reduced quantum gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensional, because all the strings, each time you take a classical limit, the strings will basically see a effective 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. So this will be a very interesting model to study, and you can, once you have the matrix model, you can discuss, you know, all the back reaction space-time, black holes, and all that. So I'll leave you with that thought, and there are other stuff that you can do with this matrix model that I'm trying to pursue at the moment, but I think I'm out of time now. So just leave you with that.
Questions and comments, please?
Alex?
How would you like to study like black holes? I mean, this is again, it's the usual problem there. I mean, you're restricting to VPS sector, which are non-interacting.
No, but I'm not, well, this time I didn't consider the VPS sector.
Because I asked you to completion, I thought it's consistent only with the VPS. Otherwise, there isn't any sense.
No, well, because of the nice properties of N equals 4, Young's theory, the SU2 sector is believed to be actually close to all loops, although there are some doubts about that. But at one loop is completely close. It's in fact close. We know that. In the large end limit, it's close.
So this is, again, you're saying it's not a VPS, just SU2.
These are not VPS states because they have anomalous dimension, and that Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian anomalous. Yeah. So these are non-trivial quantum states.
But that's at zero temperature, right? At a finite temperature, I expect everything to. So my point is.
Right.
So that's all very nice, and you have this nice sort of integrable subsectors, if you wish. But once the instance you introduce a finite temperature, the hell breaks loose. I mean, everything gets mixed with everything. So why?
Well. You can also include finite temperature in this subsector and see whether you have enough degrees of freedom to create black holes. So my first thought was
I'm just asking because this is a very nobody knows the answer.
No, I know.
Very exciting.
I don't know the answer, but I have some thoughts. I have some ideas. So what I'm trying. So you know this superstar configuration, right? So this is a singular half VPS geometry. So you know that in this geometry you have these droplets. Let's put a singular droplet, and I need to have some value in order for the geometry not to be singular. But if I put something less than that, some fractional value here, then I get a singularity. And from the 10-dimensional point of view, the whole droplet itself is a time-like singularity. And it's naked, singularity. All right, so one thing that I'm trying to understand is how to look at this from the gauge theory point of view. People have some thoughts about how this geometry arises, but no one has really found the correct operators, the precise operator. I want to find the correct operators that give me this behavior using this matrix model techniques and being able to understand this. So DJ and other people have argued that the state is given by a very long Young tuple like this, like order n on n here. So basically what you're doing is you're having a droplet that is have a lot of rings like this. And once the rings become very, very thin and very close to space, you basically have something that is like a fractional quantum holographic. You know, you have like a fractional density here. The real density of eigenvalues sort of drops out. So the first thing is to understand this geometry and understand exactly what this operator looks like in that language of the matrix model. So there is a family of 1R charged black holes that are connected to, this is the extremal version of those black holes. So one possibility to try to induce a finite horizon area is to add some wide excitations and restricting ourselves to the SU2 sector. So if you have like one or two wides, just a very few of them compared to the number of C fields, you expect something very dramatic to occur in such a state. The measure of the state will change dramatically because you cannot no longer decouple the off-diagonal elements of Z. So I think there's some, I'm trying to find ways of probing this state to see whether when you have excitations like if you induce a finite horizon or not. So when you talk about finite temperature, this is another thing. So in black hole physics, you talk about finite temperature because temperature is like Lagrange multiplier of energy. So you're only measuring the average energy of the system. But it is possible that like people like Vijay and other claim that you can look at microstates of this, a particular microstate like this. Will look, if you probe it, it would look universal. It would look just like the black hole. So for instance, if I put two wires like this, or if I move this wire here, it would look pretty much the same if I probe it like I did here. If I probe the state. So the idea is to not necessarily consider finite temperature, but consider the same microstate and probe it and see if there's some universality properties. So I can see, oh wait, large limit, this space look the same. So this is where really the entropy comes from. That is one possibility of the explanation of black hole entropy, that there's some there's universality in this state. So that is one thing I'm trying to understand. I need to do a lot of work. But I think something interesting, the possibility of really perturbing the superstar, adding some massive open strings here like this and producing an image. And this is exactly, a proposal like this was given also by Gobser and others in some papers some time ago. They have this model that I don't fully understand about how open strings on deep rings and giant gravitons give you some sort of entropy count of these black holes. I don't fully understand the paper, but it's something similar to that. So that's like one thought in my work.
This would be DPS black holes?
No. No, they're not BPS. No, they're not Spurzman. So this is the real stuff. Of course,
you can chart.
Yeah, sure, yeah. But they're still, you know, they could radiate and all that, you know, because the radiation would probably be the mixing of this state with all other states, you know, the wave function.
Any other questions? Comments? So before we thank Samuel again, let me say a few words. So this is the end of the skin-tiering subsector of our conference. And on behalf of the Institute, I would like to thank you for all the, first of all the speakers and all the participants for taking part in the conference. Of course, you're welcome to stay for other sessions, in particular after lunch.